Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
Rabbit Before Horses Strickland is one of the most celebrated fine artists in the region.
You know, just doing paintings and then rolling them up because, you know, I would sell one, but I wasn't selling a lot. And so she saw a few and she wanted to put it in an examiner. And that was on a Thursday. It went into the Sunday paper Sunday. And then that's when the calls came in.
And now he's the subject of a PBS Wisconsin television documentary. Plus, Margie Price is one of the area's best-known authors of books for young people, and she joins us for a radio reading of her newly released works.
By the time Perdant arrived, winter had settled in, and the streets were snow-covered and slippery.
All that after this.
News and issues from a superior point of view.
Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. This week, we bring you encore presentations of visits earlier in the year with two of the area's leading creative people, artist Rabbit Before Horses and author Margie Price. Margie will read excerpts from two of her latest books later in the show. First, Rabbit Before Horses, who needs little introduction in the art world locally and far beyond, and is now the subject of a PBS Wisconsin television documentary. Rabbit Before Horses Strickland was born and raised in San Francisco, far away, local author Connie LeMay writes, from the influences of his mother's Ojibwe heritage along the Wisconsin shores of Lake Superior. His mother grounded him in that culture, however, as well as in fine art, which she and several members of the family themselves practice. He adapted that and the tradition of Renaissance artists like Michelangelo and Botticelli to create a very distinct style all his own. But I'll let him tell the story, along with those close to him in his artwork, in excerpts from the recently released documentary from our television partners at PBS Wisconsin. And though you can't see the art on the radio, you can feel it in their words. Here's Rabbit Before Horses.
Well, I grew up around it. My mother was always painting, so I don't know, as a teenager, just started. Around 14. I was always drawing, though, cartoons and stuff. Yeah. My mother grew up here. And then their mother died, and they went down to the orphanage in St. Paul.
In the 20s? 30s, actually, is when they left.
They were all artists. My mother was. Her sister was, her brother was, her other brother was.
Then he came out to San Francisco, where my mother went after the war. That's my mother. The next picture is my mother, Beatrice. Just because both my mother and my Aunt Teresa were artists, you're immersed in it. All the way up to junior high, I remember that.
Well, when I was 16 and stuff, I made a lot of charts, tons of charts. Just in making up colors, you know, just having, I had these 18 by 24 sheets of paper, and I was just making 50, you know, shades of lavender, you know, and purple. I don't know why, I just did it. Different reds and, you know, just working with them. And then I even studied pictures, like a Peter Paul Rubens. He had some nice stuff with vermilion and Naples yellow, and wasn't really a red. It looks like an orange red, like capes and stuff. Yeah, that's vermilion and Naples yellow, and maybe a little burnt sienna in there. I use that. That's what I'm going to use next when I redo him.
First thing I did was, it was a copy of somebody's.
It was Zeus shooting a thunderbolt from a cloud. Really anatomical.
I'm Steve Cotherman, director of the Washburn Cultural Center, and I used to manage the museum on Madeline Island for 25 summers. Rabbit came to my attention at the museum, and we'd gotten to know each other a little bit. I found out all these other things that he was interested in, that he was a musician and had grown up in San Francisco. You know, Rabbit's a bit of an autodidact in a way. You know, I just get the feeling that he just absorbs everything around him and really doesn't. We never talked about formal education. Let me put it to you that way. He never told me, I went to this college and I did this and I did that. And it was just like, I soaked up all this stuff. You know, I went to the Palace of the Legion of Honor in San Francisco when I was a kid, and I drew copies of Caravaggio and the Masters, and I just, you know, did all this stuff. And I can just picture him as a kid hanging out at the museums in San Francisco, looking at the work and drawing it and thinking about it and absorbing it and all of that. I can just picture it. And then I get the good, warm feelings from it.
Here I was, you know, younger, copying all this Greek mythology and, you know, like digging the satyrs and the centaurs and all that stuff, and especially the satyrs, you know, like Pan and stuff. And I said, well, there it is, you know. Here I was trying to do Greek mythology, and I can do my own mythology, the Anishinaabe mythology.
My name is Winona LaDuke, Binesikwe, Indijitikaz, from Gawababanikog, Ishkanagating, from White Earth Reservation. I travel around and speak and go to meetings, and one day I was in San Francisco at the American Indian Contemporary Arts, and I saw a postcard of one of his paintings owned by Janine Antone. And I said, who is that who's doing that work? And she said, well, there's this guy named Rabbit Strickland. And I said, he's gotta be Ojibwe. And she said, yeah, he's Ojibwe. She said, he's living in different people's houses.
I was homeless in San Francisco for a couple of years. And when I was on the street, I got meatpacking paper. You know, it comes in a roll of 3 feet, long as you want. So I had a roll of that, not a whole roll, maybe 30 feet. And I would go to these places where they do construction, and they do like maybe 15 buildings or whatever, you know, at a time. They do, but what they would do is do something here, next one. So by the time they would get halfway down, I would sleep in this one. You know, I would go here, and that's where I would draw. I would draw on these. I used Prismacolors, pencils, colored pencils. Stole them. Pearl Art on Market Street. Like a buck a piece, I think. But the most I took was the black. But you use them just like an oil. So I did that for about 2 years. That was horrible. There was this church that opened like at 4 a.m, and they had a bathroom. When you went right in, I would use that in the morning to clean up. So like a lot of the homeless people I saw don't look like they bothered cleaning up. And I had a backpack. I had one change of clothes. That's what was in the backpack. And I had the pencils. And I had the tube for the meatpacking paper. At the last apartment I had in San Francisco, he converted a Victorian to 6 units. And I got one on the bottom for $900, real tiny. Okay, this is how wide it was. Okay. And it had one wall, I think 8x12. That's pretty cool. That's all I wanted. And it had one window looking out. You could see the Bay Bridge and Golden Gate Bridge. It's in Vernal Heights on top of a hill. And I had one cat derbouche, and I didn't have a bed. I slept in the corner on the floor, wood floors. And one night it was just really storming, and then this water was flying in the back. So I called the landlord. He wasn't there, blah, blah. I told him what's going on. And so I just ignored it for a while, and it was filling up back there. The drain wasn't working. So I got dressed and went out, and I saw it was shooting out of the pipe, the drain pipe coming down. It was just shooting directly in this crack. So I blocked that, and it stopped. So I left. I usually walked maybe 2 or 3 miles. I just went out the next day. He had come by to fix it. And he walked in, he saw this big painting. So one of his best friends was Annie McCowell. She controlled the pink section of the Sunday Examiner. So he told her, so she calls though and comes over. And I showed her, I had maybe 20 canvases rolled up, half of them rolled up in the corner, you know, just doing paintings and then rolling them up because, you know, I would sell one, but I wasn't selling a lot. And so she saw a few and she wanted to put it in an examiner. And that was on a Thursday. It went into the Sunday paper Sunday. And then that's when the calls came in. And I had, the rent was $900. I had $1,100. There was a show in 2 weeks. I was hoping to sell at least one. And I made so much money in 1 week. It's ridiculous, you know, way over a couple hundred grand.
I mean, they were bidding over them just because of the article. Just because of a leak. That was a big turnaround right there. Huge. And a bank account.
I knew that Rabbit was telling stories of Anishinaabe history and our mythological beings, of our beings. And I knew that very few people would know what that was. But I knew exactly what he was painting. And I was wondering why he was in San Francisco painting such a thing when the Ojibwe people would be very interested in what he had to paint. And so four different trips to San Francisco. Each time I tried to find Rabbit, and I would get closer and closer, and he would have moved someplace or moved someplace else. But the first time I met Rabbit, I met him in San Francisco at a woman's house, and I was just totally mesmerized by his painting and by his work and the stories that he was telling. And I'd come from far, and he knew that, and he knew that I had been looking for him for a while because, you know, I'm drawn to this place where we are here, Wanakwaning'minis, our island, and I am drawn to our stories. And so I found him there, and we began this long conversation about what he was doing and where he was doing it. And, you know, he kept saying to me, it's all about the walls. He would move from house to house according to who had big walls that were available. You know, he had this pattern of migration to a new place with walls where someone would offer him some Folgers coffee from what I could gather and some light eating and a place for his cat. When you're an Anishinaabe person and you see his work, it fills your heart up with something because you see something that you have heard spoken of. You see beings that you've heard stories told of, and he gives them life. He gives life to our stories in a way that no other artist that I know has. I spent a lot of time visiting with them, and then looking at me, he says, you know what my real passion is? I look at the guy, and the guy is doing like an 8x14 painting that looks like a Botticelli. And it's Anishinaabe mythological beings going through the sky on turtles with, you know, all these butterflies. And I was like trying to imagine what could be your passion more than spending 12 hours a day painting with oils in an ancient manner of ancient beings. And he said, the theory of the prime, theoretical mathematics. I thought, of course, you know, that would be what Da Vinci would say too. Someone who has that complex of a mind that can put together these multidimensional stories.
You know what odd perfect numbers are now? Okay, well, there's even perfect numbers, okay? A perfect number is a number which is the sum of its proper divisors. And the proper divisors are all the divisors except the number itself. So 6 is a perfect number. 1, 2, and 3 divide 6, and their sum is 6. That's what makes a perfect number. I think next one is 28, next one is 496, and they keep getting bigger. I don't think they know if there's infinitely many, but Euclid did that, actually, 2,000 years ago. And I think René Descartes, he invented analytic geometry. He said, I see no reason why there shouldn't be an odd perfect. So everybody started trying to resolve that, either, you know, for it or against it, it doesn't matter, resolves a resolve. This is a resolve, huh? Like a rose is a rose.
And so each time I go see him, I ask about his math. And as people know, he has a chalkboard up where he's working on his latest formula and his formulation, which, you know, I honor and am entirely baffled by. And I'm hoping that someday I can bring someone intelligent enough to his presence to have a conversation with him about theoretical math, because I am not that person, but I recognize what he's doing.
And I can see patterns and things way back, maybe 4 or 5 years old. I've always had it. With college, college is really slow. I kind of wanted just to work on certain problems anyway. So I started looking for something to create a tool for additive number theory, because they have none, to work with primes, like things like gold box hypothesis. A modern way to say that would be every even number greater than 4 can be expressed as the sum of 2 odd primes. Anything that has partitions. So I started studying partitions, and I looked at it. So if you put them in variables, C and D, you find out that C squared minus D squared equals C plus D, where C equals D plus 1. You just insert this into this, and it proves that.
When I first met him, I went up to see him and discovered that what he really, really wanted to be was the greatest Native American mathematician of all time. It's like, oh, what? So I've done the math. The math works, he says. Okay, whatever that means. You really need to tell somebody who gets that the math works, because I don't, you know.
This started in my late 20s. I had this idea here for like 10 years before I had the second part. Even though it's really simple now, it took a long time for me to see that pattern. And I would wake up maybe 2 a.m. and go write something down and dead end. It's always working on it. It must be working on it because it's amazing how all of a sudden something clicks. Like this clicked just a couple days ago. I woke up and a voice told me, check what Euler did. It's a Swedish name, E-U-L-E-R, and they pronounce it Euler. Just all I needed was a priority argument. So I knocked out half the odd integers. They can't be a perfect number. Just like that. That's so cool.
He said he wanted to go someplace, you know. First, he wanted to go to Santa Fe. And so I think that my sister, who did not have a driver's license but is a good driver, was dispatched because rabbits don't drive and rabbits don't fly, as I recall. And so I dispatched my 6'2" sister to be his partner, driving him across the country in some vehicle that he did own.
Janine Antoine was a friend of Leduc's. And one day she says, Winona LeDuc's looking for you. And I said, who's that? And she says, well, she's an old friend from college. And I said, well, does she have any big walls? You know, to paint, you know. She says, yeah, she's probably got some big walls up there. Yeah. I think it wasn't that long after that I went up there. Pretty hard to just jump up and go. I had to get Lorna Haynes to come out and drive me. I didn't know where I was going. So I paid her way on, she came out on the plane, went to Santa Fe.
We took him to Santa Fe and a great Indian art market there and enjoyed that. But you know, his real calling was to come home. So first he came back to my house and I had renovated a little cabin next door for the artist in residence. I had taken things off and extended the wall so that he could actually have a wall upon which to paint.
That's where I did Out of the Sun. I finished it there. I started it in Santa Fe. And I glazed it, and I rolled it up, and I brought it up there and finished it. Not a big wall. It was right just like that. I mean, I had to lay on the floor, you know, on the bottom. Big shaggy rug.
People from our village would go see him. You had to be careful because you interrupt him. And he's not a patient fellow. He's interested in what he's doing. And his world is so immense, and his dreams and his stories are so widespread that, you know, he has little time for others, but he would tolerate. And I just remember it was so funny, because he was just like, me and the cats, moving in. And the thing is that in my little life, you know, I felt like in this moment I could be like a benefactor to a great artist, a patroness of the arts. And so I had this moment where I felt like I could do that. And I thought about the Medici family, and I thought about how they financed Da Vinci after looting the Americas and such. And I thought, how great is it that I have this moment to be a patron to a great artist in my little modest way of, I will feed you, I will get you traveling here, I will pay some money so that you are sustained, and I will give you a place to do your art.
And then I was down in Minneapolis. I did a show down there, and I hooked up with some people, and I stayed down there for a while. I was going to go to White Earth again, but instead of turning that way, I went the other way. Up to Bayfield, full circle. I asked my mother if she wanted to go, but then she passed away. She didn't want to go. She said, what do you want to go back there for? He says, nothing there. When I first got here, I didn't know where I was, and I was looking for Rita, my cousin. Jay goes around, and she said, well, just come up, Jay, in the first right. So I was on the other side going to the first right, and I couldn't find her. I said, there's nobody here. She says, I'm standing right here. And she figured out, oh, you're on the other side. You got to come through town and then take the right. And I basically, when I got here, I slept in a car because she had a big dog. It was real mean. Me and Moose slept in a car.
And I was happy to see him when he moved back to his territory here, and happy to see his welcoming. And I'm glad he's much closer, and I'm glad he's happy here. I'm just so grateful for what he brings in his art to our communities.
When I first met him, his partner, Jeannie Buffalo, was still alive. Jeannie became ill later and passed away, but at that time, he and Jeannie were living in a house outside of Bayfield.
Then I met up with Jeannie. Show me around. I had her number from LeDuc's on the Rolodex for Redcliffe, and I just happened to be looking through that thing, and I saw that name. I said, okay, I'll get a hold of her. We hit it off right off the bat.
I did not know Jeannie before. I just knew who the Buffalo Clan was up at Redcliffe, and then I met Jeannie through Rabbit. What was amazing about that relationship was that she had a head for the details of life and for business kinds of things. She really was sort of his representative. She was making sure that people knew about his work, that things would get sold, that, you know, reproductions, prints and cards and things would get made and that they would be available for sale. And then when Jeannie got ill and then passed away, there was sort of this vacuum in a number of ways. I mean, certainly emotionally.
She got me a place to stay at her friend's house down in the basement. And then me and Moose were down there and I was painting out in her garage. It wasn't that long after that. I went over to where she lived. And Sonia was still there, that's the daughter. It was, it had her hand in everything though, a lot of stuff for the community, you know, always busy. Good writer, good speaker. Yeah, great laugh too. You could hear her across the store. If she always talking to people, but that laugh just never ended. You know? I think I got it on one of those little cassette things. Not the same, though. Somewhere within a year, she'd find out that she had breast cancer again. I think she had it 5 years earlier, and it just, it returned. So our relationship had that third party, you know, cancer. The last year was probably the worst. They travel, you know, you think you lost it, but it went somewhere else, these little cells. It went to her brain, and then it went to her vertebrae, and that was it. It was eating her vertebrae. It was pretty bad. Some of it's been really painful. It was hard to watch someone so independent get broken down, like trying to get up and put her clothes on. You know, she couldn't do that.
I watched him for a while, kind of just sort of flounder a little bit. I mean, I'm sure a lot of that was just the process of working through grief. But some of it was very practical, like who's gonna take care of my stuff, my business part. So a lot of that didn't help. But I think today he's come out of that pretty well, to the point where he shared some music with me this last year, and one of them is a song that's about her specifically. So he's worked through it, and he's back to making a lot of good paintings and having good humor, being funny again, or still. Yeah.
You've been listening to excerpts from the PBS Wisconsin television documentary, Rabbit Before Horses. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to Simply Superior and our presentation of the Rabbit Before Horses story from our television partners at PBS Wisconsin. Now in his 70s, the renowned Ojibwe artist has been painting since he was a teen. Here's more about his influences and work.
One of the things that's most interesting about Rabbit is that he gets dreams, and then the dreams tell him he's got to commit these to canvas. He has to paint the dream in order to move on to the next dream. So he had a dream about this subject, and it was going to be real complicated. There's a lot going on in this painting, and it was going to be a big painting about the right to consciousness, Native people's right to consciousness, in other words, their right to their own beings. And so he had this vision, and he thought, I live in this house with rooms that are 12 by 12 with 9-foot ceilings. If I'm lucky, where am I going to do this big painting? And he stepped into his living room, and here's the big cathedral ceiling, and he said, I'll do it in here. So the next time I went to see him, he had built a wall down the middle of the living room all the way to the top of that cathedral ceiling. So the wall was 20 feet long and 15 feet high, and he had stapled a giant canvas to it. The canvas was probably, I think, was around 17 by 9 feet. He'd staple this giant canvas up there, and he was working on this painting, and I thought, oh my God, what is this? Well, this is my dream, this is my vision, here it is, you know? And I thought, this is unbelievable. The next thing was, where are you going to show that? Well, that didn't really matter, although there was always the question of, man, I think I could sell this for a lot. There was always that. But it was like, where are you going to show it? And I said, I think you should bring it over to the museum and show it. He said, it's not finished. I said, that doesn't matter. You could come over to the museum and finish it. Let's get a stretcher frame built for this thing. We'll take it over to the museum on the island. I got one wall in the entire museum that's big enough for that painting. We commissioned the master cabinet builder to build the ultimate stretcher frame for that thing. The stretcher frame alone cost over $1,000. And then we haul it in pieces over the island. And of course, he comes over with the canvas rolled up and lay it out on the empty floor of the museum. And it took forever to get that thing stapled up and restretched. And then we hung it on the wall, and it weighed a ton because of the stretcher frame. And we had to put cleats on the wall. It was an incredible process. And then there was this giant painting. The deal was Rabbit could come in whenever he wanted and work on the painting. That actually worked, except when there were visitors in the museum, because they would distract him. They would be asking questions. And the next thing you know is he's talking to them instead of painting. And he looked at me one day and said, I don't think I'm ever going to finish this thing. But it was marvelous in the museum. It just looked incredible on that big wall. And people loved it. They just came in by the droves to see it. They were pretty fascinated by it. When the painting finally came down, we took it off the stretcher again because we couldn't even get it out of the building unless we took it off the stretcher. And then we took the stretcher apart and we wrapped up all the big pieces to it. And the next time I saw him, he was no longer living in the house with the cathedral ceiling, and he had moved into a trailer. And I went up to visit him in the middle of the winter, and there laying in the snow was the $1,000 stretcher frame. And I said, well, you need to put that in the garage or something, you know, because you're going to need to restretch that painting someday. And there's the frame. But what's so great about the guy is he wasn't thinking about stuff like that. You know, that sort of thing wasn't important. What was important was making the art, getting to the next dream and vision and the execution of that next piece.
I think it's about doing it. Yeah.
I do that with mathematics. I hit on something last week, real nice. I turned the lights off at 8 o'clock. It was just pitch black. You see how dark it gets out here. Pitch black. Beautiful idea came into my head. I said, oh, God, if I don't write it down, I'm going to forget it. I got to get up and turn the lights on and write it down. It took me like 20 minutes just to do that because I didn't want to turn the lights on. But I had to. I said, yes, it's pretty good, so...
They said, how do you do these paintings? What's the process? And he said, well, I do these drawings, and then I transfer the drawings to the big canvases. And I said, well, where are the drawings? They're around here somewhere. And well, can you show me some drawings? So he pulls out this big old beaten up portfolio, and he pulls a pile of drawings out of the portfolio, and they're all dog-eared and coffee mug stained, and they're just a mess, you know? And they were incredible. The drawings were amazing. Little notations in the margins where you could see his thought process working out and how he was going to do these and transfer them to the big canvases. And then he did grid marks on the drawings and then transfer the grid. I mean, it was just fascinating. And I said, dude, these drawings are incredible, man. We should preserve these drawings at the very least. Let's mat and frame some of these. Visitors come in and they look at Rabbit's paintings and they just go, wow, these are amazing. But for me, it's how you got to the amazing part that's most fascinating. And he'd never thought about it. He just stuffed him in the portfolio. It was amazing. That was one of the things that most endeared him to me, was just his sort of disregard for some of the things that other artists hold as precious. He just said, yeah, it's just an old drawing, you know. And I thought, ah, that's great. You know, he doesn't attach great importance to this. And that's really the sign of a guy who's got his vision and knows where he's going.
I come from a family that my mother would do a sketch and the painting would grow and change as if it had its own life. And so I am used to what begins as a piece of art, it is not what it looks like at the end. Rabbit is a much different style of painter. And he will take the image that he saw in his dream and he will make from that the story in the same image.
He's a jazz painter, man, in a way. There's just stuff that comes out that you couldn't do it again if you tried. It's just in the act of making it or the act of playing it, it just spills out. Then you can go back and review it later, listen to it or look at it, or think about it in the case of the math. But you go back and look at it later and say, I don't know where that came from, but that was pretty cool. But I still think I should move the guy's head an inch that way, right?
If you can sit there and do it, it'll look nice when it's done. You know, and I gotta change his head. I think that's it. It's making his arm look short. It's not really short.
I don't know about this. I don't want to get into his face because I'll sit here forever until I'm done.
Here is this master who is painting with this commitment to 1,000 years of story. It's an entirely Anishinaabe experience that he's painting, because when you see that art and you are learning your cultural history or you know it, you understand what that is. And different art is for different times, but his is a timeless art that speaks to this time.
That mythology is really critical to any indigenous people telling their stories. I mean, they've got to have an origin story, creation mythology. You know, mythology is only myth to a point. And there's a lot of belief systems and reality goes along with the whole creation of mythology. What I love about Rabbit's paintings is he's always got Nanabujo in there. In his heart and soul, in his mind, you got to open up the portals for those stories to flow through. And you make a deal with Nanabujo. I'll put you in all the paintings as long as you continue to feed me those stories, right? The portals are open. You know, great songwriters, they tell you that they're just a conduit. The songs come through them, not to them. And I think you see a lot of that in him. That art comes through him as much as it comes to him.
Nanabujo and the Wolf is from the recreation story. Actually, I got most of the illustrations for the recreation story, you know. Everybody thinks, you know, the him on the turtle. They think that's
the beginning.
That's the end of the story. You know, where he gets the muskrat and brings up the dirt. Yeah, that's the end. There's a whole story before that. I saw it in someone had written it out, right, way back.
They're going to start walking down to another place to sleep, and then he's going to go hunting.
But still, they're going towards where the
Mishubishu is,
the chief lynx or whatever they want to call it. They call it water monster too, so great lynx would be Mishubishu. The sleeping on the sandbar is a giveaway. That's in all the stories I've seen about it, so the background will have that water, and that's a sign of what's to come for the wolf. In the story, they're sleeping. But then the wolf gets up and goes off by himself. Nanabujo told him, if he's hunting, if he's chasing a moose or anything, if he ever comes to a stream of any kind of water, body of water, always shake a stick in there first, don't jump it. And so he didn't. When he jumped it, the Mishubishu was in there and grabbed him and ate him. And Nanabujo has that dream that something happened. Then he wakes up and goes and looks. So Nanabujo talks with the kingfisher, and kingfisher knows everything that went on. And he gives them information about what happened if Nanabujo will give them color. That's how that goes. So, and then he finds out what happened. The whole thing is tracking down the Ogima Mishubishu, the chief guy. And they describe those Mishubishus as lying on sandbars, you know, to get heat, like an alligator or some kind of amphibian. So that's how I made them. Kind of got them more like a water monster. It's actually a revenge story, a recreation story. You know, and a lot of lessons in there too. But I'm not a storyteller, so.
My understanding of the Ojibwe creation stories and the whole mythology is that Nanabujo's got kind of that trickster thing going for him, but he's also bears witness. He's such an important key component to all this. There has to be a witness, somebody to say this happened, to be there. And so he bears witness for all of the things that happen. and at the same time, he's mischievous. And that, in a sense, is Rabbit. He's a trickster, he's mischievous, and he's bearing witness today. At the ripe old age of 70 now, he bears witness to his universe and the values that he's seeing in his culture. And he does that with his paintings and indirectly with his music and his math and all of that other stuff. But really, it's about the art. Music that he cobbles together at home, and you think, you know, geez, man, this is pretty good stuff. I remember that when we're talking about San Francisco when he was a teenager, and he's playing in bands, and he's a singer, and he's been to the Fillmore, and he's been to the Avalon, and he saw, you know, the Grateful Dead, and he did this, and oh, by the way, I was going to be the singer for the Grassroots, and all of this stuff, right? You know, it's mostly just, wow, the wow factor you get.
This is a lady did when I was
not 17 yet. She was an artist. That's me. I'm sleeping on a couch and me playing a guitar. My mother played guitar and piano. Started off her. I think I had an aunt that played an organ. And then what I learned a lot from other people, you know, that I hung around with later. Yeah, more from them. JB and the Intruders. Oh my God. Yeah, that was right before the Beatles came out, Jimmy and the Intruders. A lot of like army kids, parents were in the army, playing over at Presidio Teen Club. I think it was like 5 months in that one group and then boom. The next band was The Group, always the lead singer. And I quit the other one, and back then you didn't care, and I just cutthroat. Went there, and they're all mad at me. And I went to the other group. Because they were doing like originals. You do a lot when you're young, you know. So it seems like a long time, but it's not. You're just filling up every day. All the way through about 18, then I didn't want to play no more. They were still going and I didn't want to. I started getting into painting. This one was for Jean Buffalo, after she passed. And they called her Exie, Exilda. She had a horse named Mamingua, means butterfly. In the bag, that's her Sonya Buffalo singing with me. I didn't have nothing. I didn't have nowhere to go. And I was trying to get a trailer. So I sold the painting and I got this, and then I got this cleared. But I remember the bears going through, or strawberries up here before I got up here. So they were coming through. And hanging out up here and playing out in front. It didn't bother me. A couple of big ones that walked around, you know, and looked in there. Cats were like, what? There was owls back here in the trees and falcons, you know.
It's nice out here. It's nice and quiet. Good for painting.
At the ripe old age of 70 now, he bears witness to his universe and the values that he's seeing in his culture. And he does that with his paintings and indirectly with his music and his math and all of that other stuff. But really, it's about the art.
He's the Michelangelo of the Ojibwe because of his style and his gift. He's an Italian classic painter and thinker. And let us be honest, that's a rare, rare gift that that man has. And in that style of whether it's Michelangelo or Da Vinci, where you can have this incredible artistic gift and a mathematical mind, you know, and just live in your world. You know, that's part of what I love about Rabbit is he is, you know, he's really about his world. And if you get, you know, a moment to be in his world, it's a pretty good gift. I don't ever stay long because I don't want to outlive the welcome. You know, I'm usually like, hi, how are you? But, you know, I would not want to ever outlive the welcome.
They like it. They like it a lot. They like that blood in you and me, yeah. Sure enough, they want it, hey, hey, every drop.
That would be the end of that one. Just sing, go out singing, Everybody Wants to Be an Indian.
Everybody want to be.
I don't know.
An Indian.
You know.
Everybody want to be.
You've been listening to excerpts from the television documentary Rabbit Before Horses by PBS Wisconsin. It was produced by Mick Dirks for PBS Wisconsin and featured Rabbit Before Horses Strickland, Steve Kotherman, and Winona LaDuke. And yes, you've also been listening to the music of Rabbit Before Horses. You can find out more at pbswisconsin.org. Coming up, author Margie Price, after this. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. My guest is described on her website as an author, speaker, and proud Minnesotan, although I think I can say she's no less proud to venture across the bridge from her Duluth home to share in the life of Superior in Northwest Wisconsin. Her books, primarily for young readers, have made it on the New York Times bestseller list, among them Heart of a Samurai, which was named the Newbery Honor Book. She's also received much acclaim for The Peace Bell. Welcome to Simply Superior, Margie Price.
Hi.
So you have two new books, Village of Scoundrels, which just came out in February, and The Littlest Voyager. You were scheduled to have numerous dates of readings for those launches, and then the virus hit.
Village of Scoundrels is based on the true story of a village in France that during World War II sheltered many hundreds, possibly thousands of Jewish children and teens rescued from French concentration camps. And I got interested in the story. I actually bumped into a little snippet about this village when I was researching Shadow on the Mountain, which is another one of my books based on a true story during World War II of a young boy who got involved in the resistance in Norway. So the snippet that I read was about a village in France that sheltered these children, and they were located on a high plateau, kind of a remote area in France, and so they didn't even have a policeman in their village. So that made it kind of a good place to hide if you had to hide. Mm-hmm. But the gendarmes, the French police in the valley, in the city in the valley, found out that they were doing this. And so from time to time, they would send up several cars full of gendarmes to go hunt for these kids. And when that happened, the villagers would send the children out into the forest to hide, or they would tell them to go pick mushrooms or blueberries. And when the gendarmes went away, the village children would go out in the forest and sing a little song, letting the hidden children know that it was safe to come back.
Hmm. And this is based on a true story. So.
This is a true story, yes. This is a village, Le Chambon-sur-Lignon. It's not unknown. There are other books written about it. What's different about my book is that when I started reading up on the village, I started realizing that a lot of the people who were involved in this rescue effort were teenagers, which is who I often write for. And so I got real interested in looking more closely at the young people who were sheltered there and the young people who became forgers and people smugglers and couriers for the resistance and many other ways that they got involved in helping these war refugees to stay safe or be smuggled to Switzerland.
Mm-hmm. And the little Voyager?
Yeah. Now, if you just need a good laugh,
okay,
and to have some fun.
We could use that now, yes.
Right, and to enjoy the North Woods vicariously, this is your book. The Littlest Voyager is about a red squirrel. His name is Jean-Pierre Petit Le Rouge, and he wants to become a voyageur. So he stows away on a voyageur canoe. And as you might expect, if you know red squirrels at all, it doesn't go particularly well.
I haven't really made their acquaintance in that environment, but go ahead, yes.
Well, you can imagine what it would be like to have a squirrel in your canoe with you.
Oh, okay, right. Yeah.
He manages to hang on.
All right.
although, from Montreal, which is where he stows away, he gets all the way to Grand Portage.
Mm-hmm.
Only to discover what it is the voyageurs are there to do and there to trade. So once he discovers, he gets into this storeroom and sees these piles of his animal brethren's hides, he has a change of heart.
Okay. We are talking to Margie Price, the author of Village of Scoundrels and The Littlest Voyageur. So could we hear a little bit from each?
Sure. So I'll start with Village of Scoundrels. And I'm just going to start pretty close to the beginning. They find out that they're hiding Jews and other war refugees, and they send a policeman to spy on the villagers.
Okay.
His name is Inspector Perdin, which in French means loser. So he enters the village at this point. By the time Perdin arrived, winter had settled in, and the streets were snow-covered and slippery. Since the village was built on the side of a steep hill, this could make for treacherous going. He was mincing his way to the cafe across from his hotel when a loud, sustained shriek made him stop in the middle of the street. Someone in danger? Distress? Perhaps his brand new job as a sole police officer was about to begin with something truly dramatic. He turned his head, all his senses alert. Maybe one of the illegals said to be hiding here was trying to murder someone. If he could just pinpoint where the scream was coming from, he would dash to the rescue. The high, keening "ee" transformed to a squeal of "ah!" And did he detect an element of glee in that scream? The sound grew closer and clearer, like a train engine echoing between stone walls, now muffled, now screaming, now rounding a corner, gathering speed. Then there, careening at high speed down the street, aimed straight at him, came a train of sleds ridden by teenagers. Surely they'll stop, Perdin thought. He flung up his free hand, palm first, as if he might stop them by sheer force of will. Quickly realizing that they couldn't possibly stop, he lunged out of their way at the last moment. Oh! The riders screamed as they rocketed past him. No sooner had one sled gone by when another followed, and then another. A cap blew off, a glimpse of red stockings, a hair ribbon, snow-frosted eyeglasses. Did that boy just stick his tongue out as he whisked past? A little brown and white dog chased after, barking and barking. The squeals of delight echoed between the village shops, then changed tone when the team zoomed past the town square. Sparks flew from the metal runners, as the sleds clattered over the railroad tracks and the screams faded as the riders rounded the corner and headed toward the bridge that spanned the river. He knew the town was full of teenagers. They came from all over France to attend some kind of exceptional high school meant to promote peace and international unity. A little too late for that, Verdun thought. Many of these students lived in boarding houses. It was known that some of them were foreign Jews and other illegals and undesirables. And since he was also quite sure it was not legal to ride sleds down the main street, there were obviously delinquents among them. Scoundrels, Perdant said aloud before he stepped into the cafe, notebook under his arm, ready to begin his first report.
And the littlest voyager?
Yeah, I'll read a little bit. As I mentioned before, Jean-Pierre Petit Le Rouge, a red squirrel, longs to be a voyageur. From his treetop perch near Montreal, he watches as the voyageurs return. And he says, sometimes on their return, I caught the scent of the far away, pine cones sticky with rosin, the sweet sap of maple trees, musky mushrooms, juicy berries, a multitude of nuts and seeds yet to be tasted. It was a smell that stirred up in me a wanderlust, a call to adventure of the grandest sort. I want to be a voyageur, I told my friends. When his friends scoff at him, he says, why should I not be a voyageur? Because you are a squirrel, my friends argued. Because you cannot paddle a canoe. Because you cannot cook. Because at the portages, you cannot carry a heavy bundle. This is what I said to them. I may not paddle, but I can sing. I may not cook, but I can eat. I may not carry much, but I can carry something. Well, said my friends, they will never let you into their canoe. Perhaps, I agreed, but their canoes are so big, there are plenty of places to hide, and I am so small, I can fit into one of their vest pockets. So that's exactly what he does, is hide in a vest pocket, until he can't stand it anymore, has to get out.
Sure.
So.
All right. Well, I can only imagine the fun that he has when he gets out. So.
Yeah, and then he starts getting in trouble right away.
As
for one thing,
do.
He really, really likes to sing, but the voyageurs don't appreciate his singing. If you've ever heard a red squirrel on the top of a tree rolling his R's as better than any Frenchman alive, you'll know why.
Right. Well, we won't ask you to do that right now. The website is Margie Price, MargiePreus.com. Margie Price, thank you for joining us on Simply Superior.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.